Hello, and welcome to the Sheldrake Vernon Dialogues with myself, Mark Vernon, and Rupert Sheldrake. Hi there, Rupert.
Hello, Mark.
These are conversations that we have on subjects we've been reading about or we feel are in the air, just to kind of see where they go, to bring together what we know about it, tease out new things by our exchange, and hope very much that that prompts you too to have new thoughts, put together things that links that you hadn't quite put together before, and maybe yourself or sharing with others. So please do kind of spread the dialogue and spread the word. Rupert, I thought today we could talk about a theme that I feel is growing, actually, and it's the notion of spiritual crisis. And it's the idea that our culture is not just in a kind of environmental crisis, although it is, not just in a kind of economic or political crisis, which in Britain isn't sort of not hard to believe as well at the moment, in the political side anyway, but that these different things grow out of a more fundamental spiritual crisis for our culture, which I guess a shorthand would be to say that we've become uncoupled from the foundations of our life, which are not just biological, not just psychological and emotional and so on, but are in some way spiritual or transcendent. And that this crisis is manifesting itself, not just in terms of things that you see at a social level, but also in people's lives. That the mental health, I think, sort of epidemic that we feel we're in the middle of, you know, this idea that maybe one in four people are having some serious mental health problem, be that depression or anxiety or more serious conditions, that is partly, can be partly understood psychologically, can be partly understood physiologically, and but also increasingly needs to be understood spiritually. And that, in fact, the mental health profession is recognizing this because, for example, the College of Psychiatrists has a very large spirituality interest group. And there are other organisations that are trying to think about mental health through spiritual concerns. So that's sort of to sort of paint the sense of why this thing called spiritual crisis might be significant at the moment, and how it's showing itself, at least. I mean, does that resonate with things that you come across as well?
Oh, definitely. I would think it's both spiritual and religious. I mean, spiritual in the sense that the spiritual crisis manifests in these mental health issues, anxiety issues, and personal problems. But religious in the sense that religions are what hold societies together traditionally, which build communities. The spiritual approach is, at least in our individualistic society, easily seen as an individual issue, whereas I think there's a collective issue too. And traditional societies which have a cohesion through their shared religious pursuit, whatever the religion is, come together on festivals, through joint rituals, through joint celebrations, through singing, through chanting, through a whole range of ceremonies and rites of passage. And owing to the decline of adherence to the Christian tradition in Europe and increasingly in North America, that the cohesive collective side of it is declining as well. And so obviously related, but I think it's, as far as I can see, the issue involves both religious, in other words, the collective, as well as the individual dimension.
Yeah, Rowan Williams recently spoke about this, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, who I think is one of our great spiritual luminaries, and he understood the link between the personal and the collective by saying that the trouble is that we live in a culture that is unreal about so much, that at the personal level we live a kind of unreal life because we feel that the fulfillment of our lives, our personal flourishing, can be, say, measured in very material terms, as if all we have to do in life is pursue more and more material goods, material goods are very lovely in their own way, but they're not enough. That was sort of his point at the personal level. But then that gets replicated at the social level, where we organise our economy as if there's indefinite material growth heading off into the future, or as if we are building a world where everyone's material concerns can be sort of seamlessly delivered. And again, he feels that collectively too, there's a kind of unreality to that, because not only is the dream impossible, but actually it distorts what it is to be human. Its vision of what it is to be human gets distorted in the process. So the trouble is that the individual is living with a kind of distorted sense of what life may be about, but the society too, our Western society, has grown up with a distorted sense of what life might be about. And it's subtle, because many of the good things that we enjoy have come about through that distortion. The fact that we can easily access food, we can have lots of material pleasures, we can travel. You know, in many respects, our health is like it's never been, perhaps, in human history. But nonetheless, that very good set of good things has meant we've become uncoupled from these other things, both personally and socially. So the idea is that recognising the crisis means that we can perhaps begin to readdress the balance, I suppose. And that means becoming more alert to other sides of what it is to be human, and both personally and then, you know, at the collective level in some way or other, trying to re-engineer almost our society to become more alert to these spiritual things again, the spiritual goods of life.
Well, in a sense, one of the easiest places to start is with individual practices, because individuals can make decisions and get on with it, whereas changing the collective life is much more difficult. In my recent book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, and in the previous one, Science and Spiritual Practices, I'm dealing with practices that people can actually take up, which do lead to a greater sense of spiritual connection. Many of them are individual. Meditation, for example, taking psychedelics, in many cases done individually, although it can be done collectively, as in ayahuasca ceremonies. But some of them are collectives, holy days and festivals, celebrations you do with other people, rituals. Singing and chanting are things that you do with other people. So you can do them on your own, but they're traditionally done in groups, and they work best in groups. Connecting with nature, again, is that something more individual for most people in our post-romantic culture? I mean, well, you can go on expeditions with friends and so on, but personally, I find I connect much more with the natural world if I'm on my own, because if I'm with other people, I spend the time talking and just don't notice so much about my surroundings. So the individual spiritual practices are perhaps the easiest to adopt, and the most individual are the easiest of all, like meditation and yoga, and those are things which indeed are hugely widespread now in our society. The collective ones are harder, because if they involve taking part in exotic spiritual traditions, Sufi dancing, you know, Hindu bhajan chanting, neo-shamanic ceremonies from Peru or Native American or the ceremonies, then they don't connect with the history and mainstream of our society, and they remain niche cult, not exactly cult, but subgroup. Niche activities. Whereas in Western Europe, the mainstream tradition is Christian. That, of course, is fragmented into Protestant, various Protestant groups, and Catholic. And there it's harder to get cohesion, even in the 19th century, when many more people were religious in the Christian sense. It was harder to get cohesion because of Catholics, Anglicans, Methodists, Baptists, Seventh-day Adventists, and Christian scientists, I mean all sorts of groups just here in England, Quakers, and of course many more in the United States. But I do think some of the things that can help to bring us together are the festivals and pilgrimage, which we've talked about before, because that connects to places, and we need to be rooted in the land, And the festivals link us together in time. We need to be rooted together in the seasons of the year. And so those are very fundamental practices, I think, that help root us. But unless we have these reconnect back, then it's hard to see how we can form a meaningful connection, not just directly between ourselves and the spiritual realm, but something that includes other people, the society in which we live, and above all, the world in which we live, which is now so hopelessly out of balance. I mean, the advantages we all have, jet travel, plenty of heating, fuel, energy, food, have largely come at the price of exploiting the natural resources of the planet, burning up millions and millions of years of carbon deposits from the sunlight and photosynthesis in coal and gas and oil, just plundering the Earth's resources. Now, that's the state we're in at the moment. Those advantages come at that price, and I think that's part of the crisis as well.
Yeah, I mean, I completely take the point about the personal side being one thing, the collective something else entirely. And I'm not sure at all whether this is not going to be a great tragedy in our culture, in our civilization even. I really think it could go that way. But in the meantime, trying to notice where you feel there are changes that are positive, I feel I see them broadly in two domains. One is more a more constructive kind of rethink about things. So, for example, I mean, we were just talking about Robert McFarlane's new book, Underground, partly because it features one of your sons, Merlin.
Underland.
It features Merlin. And, you know, this is a tremendously popular book, and I think it must be speaking to people. And so that sense of re-engaging with nature, maybe it's post-romantic, but nonetheless with a sort of felt sense of connection, as if nature has got something to give you as much as you to observe in it, I think is there's hope there. And I wonder whether, at least marginally, and I think it is only marginally, but maybe marginally, people are trying to think now about what makes for a good life. One idea that I really like actually comes from, it's very ancient, it comes from Boethius and the Consolations of Philosophy. But in one section of that book, Boethius asks philosophy, he has this vision of Lady Philosophy, and he asks her, you know, so what is true wealth? And Lady Philosophy gives these kind of criteria by which you can know what is truly worth calling wealth, as opposed to things which are partial wealth, so partial goods. So, you know, money has a good side to it, but it's a partial good, she says. But the thing you can notice with true wealth is that, for example, with true wealth, you actually have it already. You don't need to kind of go out and try and find it and accumulate it. You don't need to fear that you're going to lose it or that it'll be given away. True wealth you have already. And it really made me think about, you know, what do I have already that I regard as my true wealth? And I guess it's things like, you know, life itself. It's things like the love of others. In a more spiritual sense, I think it is the deepening sense that the transcendent isn't some other place, but the transcendent is something that I can know within my own self as well. Mm. And to gradually reorientate my own sense of wealth away from the humdrum, you know, needs and necessities to some degree of the everyday, and really think, no, this is the kind of wealth I'm organising my life around, to become more and more aware of the wealth I have already. I mean, I think to bring it right back down to earth, another practice which I think you talked about before is gratitude. Mm. And maybe part of the reason why gratitude is such a useful practice is because in some ways it is to give thanks for true wealth and not just passing, you know, pleasures.
Well, I agree. I think that's a very important starting point. And it would actually become much more relevant to us if we start thinking in terms of economic growth, which ceases to be growth. We think about an economy which isn't growing very much or is even shrinking. In many countries, especially Japan, which is ahead of the rest of the world, the population is declining. It's going down by about 300,000 a year. We're used to the idea of endless population growth, and that's certainly happening in the world as a whole still. But In many countries, they've passed the tipping point where the fertility rates are now below replacement rate. And in the next few decades, we're going to see populations declining in many parts of the world, a situation we're just not used to at all. With that will also go a decline in economies, and also with the scarcity of raw materials and the need to have energy technologies that are not so wasteful, less throwing away of plastic bottles, all the things that we're hearing about and which we're becoming more aware of through Extinction Rebellion and other large-scale movements. Then we have to prepare for a way of running our societies which is not all about growth, economic growth. And that would then mean true wealth. People are not going to say, oh, we vote for poverty, but they might vote for true wealth.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether there's a way of trying to run with the human impulse to grow, which I think is quite a basic human impulse, but what to recognise that it's got a bit diverted into material growth and needs to be a bit like a river, sort of, that got channeled off in the wrong direction, and needs to the real deeper flow needs to be reopened, which is in terms of spiritual growth. I mean, I think about a lot about this in relation to the area that I work in of psychotherapy, and what, as a psychotherapist, one hopes to achieve with an individual, and or indeed with a group. And I think one of the things that distinguishes psychotherapy from, say, other kinds of behavioural therapy is that it says not that we're gonna set some goals, say, for example, to get you back to work and become a sort of contributing member of society again. Although that is in itself not a bad thing. I don't think that's a bad thing in itself. But what it says is we don't know quite what the goals are, and we're going to try and treat this thing that you perceive as a problem as actually a symptom, and try and discover what it's a symptom of. And I think often mental health symptoms are almost like guides to maybe a truer vocation. You know, maybe your work, which you have to do, but it's become, as it were, the whole of your life. And you've got it confused with perhaps what is your deeper vocation, which is to be engaged and interested and energised, to feel passionate about something else that maybe can run alongside your work, but nonetheless you feel your life is more clearly rooted in. So it's a model of health that, rather than thinking about health in terms of functionality, you know, which is sort of the standard model, maybe thinks about health in terms of, I don't know, harmony or integration, that sees life made up of different parts, and that if one of the parts goes missing, then life as a whole tends to sort of come unstuck, if not fall apart. And so symptoms of that show up, say, in mental health, and given the time and the patience, and it is about bearing suffering, because you know, people genuinely do suffer. But if that can be borne, and I think it can often be borne if it's felt like it's shared, and then gradually something new can show up through the difficulty that can be actually transformative, and not just, as it were, getting you back on the old track. So it's rethinking what we think we're doing with health as well, that I think, as well as the economy, and what real growth is in terms of say health as well as economic growth. I wonder whether maybe we're beginning to see some signs of that. Occasionally, I think psychotherapists often try and champion that way of thinking about things. And in hospitals, maybe the hospice movement is a bit of a similar thing in terms of physical well-being, that a hospice is a place where not just dying is seen as part of living, but that dying is seen as a chance to grow in its own way. That's not just about becoming physically well, because... as it were, in extremis, you've gone beyond the point where you're ever going to be physically well again. But that's not the end point, in fact. There's now a whole new process, a different kind of growth that can be undergone with the right support, which you can find in a hospice.
Well, yes, I think that there's... if we're going to think about life as a whole, we have to think about death and an approach to death which is not just fearful and based on trying to put it off as long as possible at whatever the expense. one of the things about the spiritual practices that I've written about in my recent books is that they have a lot of scientific evidence now showing that they're beneficial. I mean, people who meditate or pray tend to be happier, healthier, and live longer. There's now a great deal of evidence for the benefit of these things. And personally, because I like experiments and things, I think some of the approaches you're talking about could actually be tested scientifically. For example, if a group of people are feeling some kind of spiritual angst, and or even individuals, but I'm thinking more of groups, and if they go, say, on a pilgrimage together, one could compare the effects of one group or of people going on a pilgrimage together, which is a physical expression of a spiritual journey, which can often bring healing and sense of purpose, meaning, and reconnection to the land as you walk through it, and to a kind of another dimension, because each place of pilgrimage, which is a place of linking heaven and earth, is a place of healing or wholeness. Comparing that with just going on a holiday together or some other, or just not doing anything together, these things could actually be studied experimentally and in terms of their outcomes. And if it turns out that these group activities are beneficial, then it might persuade more people to take them up, or even for health professionals to prescribe them, or for people in charge of pastoral welfare at schools and colleges and universities to encourage them. Because instead of them being seen as an expression of blind belief or irrational faith or superstition or just kind of New Age folly, they can be seen, I think, for what they are, and most of them are indeed deeply healing practices, because they're about connection and wholeness, and wholeness and healing, of course, are very closely related.
Yeah, I mean, I believe there are some GPs now who will prescribe a kind of social project, say, working in a woods or forest for depression, for example. It depends, as it were, who your GP is, whether they... Mm. Are prepared to do that. I don't know whether organisations like NICE have ever tested these things, but broadly the idea is that a depression can be a sign of feeling very trapped, and that if you treat that as a symptom rather than, say, as a problem, the idea is that by, say, going and doing a day's work outside, which a depressed person may not have done for a long, long time, you actually discover not just, as it were, a therapy to alleviate your sense of being indoors and locked inside your mind, but actually discover another vitality completely, which is the vitality of the natural world. And that this itself is to kind of awaken up to something which you've, as it were, missed, you've forgotten kind of existed. Mm. So it's to use the depression as an indicator of something that is there to be discovered, which then, you know, might happen with a kind of social intervention rather than, say, with a medical intervention. So that idea of recovering other dimensions, I think, has got to be part of what a spiritual crisis is about, that it's through the crisis that the sense of another dimension opens up.
Mm. One thing that I ponder over is whether this is peculiar to Europe and North America, or how worldwide this crisis is, because if you go to other parts of the world, and I was in Brazil recently, for example, and I was at a gathering of anthropologists, it so happens, and so I asked people who actually study social patterns in South America, you know, would you say that there's a general trend in Brazil and elsewhere in South America, like the secularization in Europe, more and more people giving up any traditional religious pursuits and becoming more individualist, disconnected from all spiritual traditions, and so on. And their answer was no, that's not what's happening here at all. The pattern that we see in Europe, that we have done for generations now, is not what's happening there. What's happening there is not that people are giving up a belief in a spiritual or religious dimension of life, or giving up a sense of its importance. There's a mass switching from popular Catholicism to Pentecostalist churches, mega churches and things, which have spirit possession, you know, things which have always been popular in Brazil. They have holy water, which has always been part of the Catholic tradition, sort of reformulated versions. That's what's happening there. What's happening in India, no doubt among Muslims, there must be, you know, perhaps an unwelcome growth of Islamic fundamentalism. There's certainly a growth of Hindu fundamentalism. But is it that in other parts, in China, there's probably a rise in religious faith and belief and practice compared with the negative effects of Maoism? In Russia, there certainly is. So I think the pattern we're seeing in Western Europe and North America, well, actually all of Europe except for Russia, may be peculiar to our particular historical circumstances. I just don't know enough about the rest of the world. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I that's very interesting to hear, and I wonder about that as well. I mean, certainly if you go to places like India, you feel that other dimensions of life, divine and natural, are alive and kicking quite clearly.
Yes.
There is this phenomenon of nationalism, and my sense of that would be it's a kind of pseudo-good, a bit like money being a pseudo-form of wealth, and that what nationalism gives you is a sense of life beyond your own individual life. It's a collective form of life, but it's one that very much depends upon identifying enemies, and, as it were, having clear sense of those who don't belong to your national group, who are the enemies, maybe the invaders within your nation state. That is energizing, but in a very destructive and frightening, often frightening way, unless you're part of the dominant group. So it's a sort of pseudo-spirituality, I think. I mean, you know, it's often remarked that nationalism and a kind of right-wing spirituality do go together. And I think that this kind of idea of discerning where the life is coming from, and if it's a kind of passion that comes out of a sort of hatred and a desire for purity, a desire to expel that which is perceived as infecting a group, that kind of vitality needs to be sort of nailed and shown that it's not part of a truer mystical tradition, which ultimately, again, in the Christian tradition, which is the one I know best, goes all the way back to figures like the Desert Fathers saying that a true spirituality, a true mysticism, isn't about escaping, it's about seeing more clearly. And the more clearly you can see, the more you can actually tolerate difference, you can tolerate suffering, because your life is seen to be bigger than the difference, bigger than the suffering. Again, it's connecting to the divine, to a true transcendent source. So I guess that with a lot of these developments, which are in a way good at face value, say the charismatic movement, Pentecostal movements, I wonder whether what they might also need, maybe in a sort of second wave now, is a kind of sense of discernment, so that this can be, it becomes part of human growth again, becomes part of human development, rather than just, say, a reaction against a dominant sense of, you know, materialism and anxiety and so on.
Well, I think this is where the connection with the earth becomes so important, because nationalism is largely about other groups of people. You know, they're the enemy, they're trying to take over, etc. But you don't get that feeling about land. I mean, I don't feel that the continent of Europe's trying to take over the island of Great Britain. And, you know, the land is here, and I don't feel that sort of North America is going to take over the land of South America. The land itself isn't doing that. People from there might be doing it. Then you have a kind of nationalist or political conflict. But when we recognise that we all depend on the earth, the land, the climate, the winds, the oceans, those are totally transnational, and they're transnational in a good sense. Unfortunately, the whole idea of globalism and transnationalism has become linked to neoliberalism, corporate interests, you know, vast multinational globalizing activities, which nationalism is in part, and the far right and stuff are often a reaction against those globalized interests. But if the globalism is about Gaia, about the planet, then I think that's a very different thing, and something much healthier and something much more positive.
Yeah, I mean, this is in line with what you're saying there, but maybe just a tweak, that sometimes people say that land is a legal and political idea, So, you know, the kind of nationalisms we'll talk about, we belong to this land, whereas nature is something that exceeds any kind of human definition. And so Gaia, for example, would be about connecting with nature, and which is a sort of shared common good, and again is a sort of a source of wealth that if we learn to relate to it to a right, keeps on giving.
Mm.
So just with that nuance, because I know that, say, in National Socialism through the 20th century in Germany, you know, the land became part of the rallying call for, you know, for the Nazis. Mm. And so maybe we need to make that distinction between, we're talking about something that exceeds anything that humans can kind of package and commodify,
yes,
can buy and sell, you know, like you can with land. I know it's a slightly semantic point, but I think, again, in this sort of shift of perception, it's about how we can relate to something that's bigger than ourselves and form a kind of healthy, harmonious, real relationship with that which is bigger than ourselves.
Yes, and this is, of course, a big political issue, too. It's to do with the environment, Extinction Rebellion, the decline of species, and many of them are migratory. I mean, many of the migratory species we have in Britain are in decline, and that's because birds that come from Africa get shot on the way across the Mediterranean, or their habitats are being destroyed in Africa as well as them being poisoned here. So these do actually give, as soon as we begin to think about the animals and plants, we especially the animals, we tend to get this bigger picture. Because they're also vulnerable to climate change and to agricultural practices. And then this brings us back to the political and economic issues. Do we want vast feedlots of cattle? Do we want vast prairie farms producing huge amounts of food, a lot of which is wasted, and so forth? So the spiritual crisis does tie in again, come back again to these economic and political concerns. But I think raising this level of spiritual awareness and spiritual connection has to be, it seems to me, almost the only way forward from the spiritual crisis you're talking about.
Well, I mean, I agree, because I think otherwise, just to know about, say, the decline of species, the extinction of your birds, of insects, of plants, it becomes overwhelming because the numbers are already, you know, so dramatic.
Mm.
And as a way, if you just treat it as a kind of, well, again, a sort of material, biological kind of problem, then people, you know, get burnt out and trying to devise the right policy becomes just sort of intimidating. Now, I'm not suggesting there's an easy way out of it, but I think that with a kind of a bigger spiritual vision, the idea would be that helps you to contain what is very tragic and can be very, very distressing, in order to keep engaging with it. I think that, you know, must come at the end of the day from a sense that life actually is given to us, that comes from a source bigger than ourselves, that it's kind of gifted to us, and in a way can survive, you know, whatever we can do to it. I mean, in a way, this is the sort of dark side of the Gaia hypothesis, but I find it sort of hopeful at the same time, strangely enough, when James Lovelock talks about how, you know, we can't actually destroy the planet. This kind of rhetoric is completely inaccurate. Gaia will survive.
Mm.
And the question is whether we're going to work with Gaia or not.
Mm.
And that sort of sense, again, of kind of harmony. Justice would be the ancient Greeks' way of putting it. Aristotle talked about justice. And for him, justice wasn't about me asserting my rights against your rights. Justice was about trying to find a way of life that could accommodate all aspects of life, that was in harmony with all aspects of life. So realizing that that nature, that life, that the gods, there we can't actually kill them. They will go on, even if they suffer. And so that, in a way, is a bit freeing, a bit liberating, to think, okay, so the task now is to learn how to work with these things more. It sort of reframes things a bit,
yes,
rather than landing the whole problem upon our plate and then, you know, out of fear or distress, feeling there's nothing much we can do about it.
And overcomes the idea that it's either for our good or for the good of the earth. It's for both.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a difficult thing. And again, in a lot of spiritual traditions, it's pretty common to, as the Buddhists put it, to realise that the obstacles are the way, or in Christianity to realize that there's a kind of dying that needs to take place before a new birth. That's not to say you will the obstacles and you will the death, but maybe again this spiritual perspective can give people some sense that through the crisis there is new life to be found on the other side of it.
Well, very good to end on a note of hope.